I ever have a cent, I'll be rich as Rockefeller. Gold dust at my feet on the sunny side of the street.
Welcome to the Friday edition of the Large Morning Show in the afternoon here on the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Dan Strauss and Ian Geis are here in the studio with me. And to start the show today, we have a special guest joining us. The first time I saw this gentleman was 30 years ago when he was taking a shower in front of 10,000 people at the Universal Amphitheater in Los Angeles at the first Comic Relief concert. The last time I saw him was just a couple of years ago when he was appearing at the Funny Bone in Valley Park. And between then and the first time, he...
I haven't had a shower yet.
He has not showered since then.
I'm a little ripe today, a little gamey.
He has done a bunch of movies. He's directed several movies. He's done TV shows and directed Dave Chappelle's show and Jimmy Kimmel Live and Mark Maron's show on IFC. Done a ton of animated projects and video games, and now he's back in St. Louis to work right here at Westport at the home of the St. Louis Funny Bone. Bobcat Goldthwait is here. Hi, Bob.
Well, hi. How are you? It's nice to be in the people aquarium.
Yeah, it is.
Nice. Well, we're
it's
here
a
with
really
our
strange setup, yeah. And how often do you have people just looking at you?
Quite often.
Quite often. Yeah. Is it awkward or is it...
Well, I sit with my back to the window, so yeah. The other guys are freaked out by it a little bit.
That's how we get down who runs this, who's in charge.
We pick our nose a lot. <stuff. laughs>
There's some jerk staring at us. Oh, that's the general manager. That's not a stalker. That's
yeah, we
not,
throw poop at him.
I had the weirdest fan last night right here. Not a fan. He was a guy who collects autographs, and he was sitting downstairs, and he goes, "Hey, Bobcat." And I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Can I have an autograph?" I go, "Yeah." I go, "Oh, I got to come over to you." He just did the laziest autograph.
He stood there.
No, he sat down about 40 feet away. And I go, "Oh, maybe he can't walk." He can walk. He got up. And and then I could tell he was a really hardcore fan of mine because he had a picture of me on his phone that he held up to me as I was signing it, because he didn't believe I was me. I don't know.
You signed the phone?
No, but he just was like, look at like...
That might not be Bobcat Goldthwait. Yeah. I'll get the autograph, but I need visual proof.
It's either Bobcat Goldfarb or Gilbert Gottfried. I'm not 100% sure who I've been sitting here waiting for to get an autograph.
For people who heard me introduce you and think I was joking, you did take a shower in front of 10,000
people.
Yeah, I did.
And they were very cold. It was the producers weren't. The shower was very cold. The producers weren't crazy about the fact that I was making them put a shower on stage.
Yes.
So they had ice cold water.
They rolled a bathtub out,
yeah,
didn't they?
Yeah, I brought the bathtub, but they weren't excited about it. They just want a guy to go up and grab a mic and tell jokes. And then I said, "No, I'm going to take a shower on stage," because I said I was nervous. And a lot of people sing better in the shower because they're relaxed. And I think I'm funnier in the shower.
Mm-hmm.
But for the record, I did get nude in that shower. I was about to ask that. I'm a method actor. No, I just thought it'd be funny to be. But that was back in the day when I did scream, but the screams in the shower were genuine because it was really cold water.
It was funny because here at the first Comic Relief, it wasn't just Billy and Whoopi and Robin.
Yeah, no, they always had other comics, but yeah, I dressed as Christ once there and did magic tricks, and boy, people hated that. I was the amazing Christo, you know, water to wine to water, tap the deck, it's back to rice again. Is pick a loaf, any loaf. And I remember, and I really bombed. Like, I've seen that since, and they've sweetened it for laughs because
really?
There was not a laugh to be had. There was a woman that had a sign, went up in the balcony and said, "I heart Bobcat." And as I went down in flames, I saw the sign going lower and lower. And it was much like the real Christ, you know. It was like, "You were with the Galilean." "No, I wasn't." You know,
What's happening on the inside of your head
when you're bombing like that? It was a real hard bomb. I felt bad, you know, because every time you come up with an idea, you don't stuff like that. You know, I would always do odd stuff on my earlier stand up, and I just thought, well, they like this, they're gonna like this. You know, I mean, I didn't expect them not to. You know, it's always been like that. But so yeah, it's like my early stand up would be just me reading a Dear John letter in tears. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'd just start, you know, doing a stand up set, and then I'd break down and explain I had, and then read this letter.
Hey, you know what?
Ask the audience what they thought of it. Like, what does this mean? And clearly, she didn't want to go out with me anymore. And by the way, it was a real letter. And
then, oh, wow.
And then I'd be crying, and then I'd get back to my act, and I'd be like, you know, my wife is so fat. You know, how fat is she? I told you, I don't even have a girlfriend. You know, so I would always do these conceptual pieces when I first started. And then I got known, and then I actually had to go and become a comedian.
When did the screaming start?
Well, the character that I did was always, when I was a kid, I started when I was 15, 16 doing stand-up, but I got an alarm when I was 20. But I would always, like, these concept pieces, but I would do this character that actually, it's funny, I'm wearing, I believe, a Bigfoot t-shirt, because it was a guy who had seen Bigfoot, so I'd go up on stage, and I was this guy, and I was really nervous. But the screaming and yelling and all that probably came later on when I was much more comfortable doing a character, but it came later on when people would start heckling it. So the guy became kind of scary as a defense mechanism.
Probably not the right character to heckle on stage, because that character was willing to go crazy.
Yeah, especially back then, it was really extreme, you know, and it was slightly homicidal, you know, in the things it was saying.
Speaking of things from the beginning of your career, you made a terrific documentary, came out last year or the year before,
thanks.
Called Call Me Lucky.
Yeah.
It's about a guy by the name of Barry Crimmins, who I actually got to see because when I was in my late teens or early 20s, I went up to Boston.
Wow.
And I went to this place that he ran.
The Ding Ho.
The Ding Ho. It was a Chinese restaurant with a comedy club inside.
Yeah.
I had heard about the other places, Nick's Comedy Stop
Nick's
and the Comedy Connection.
Comedy Connection. But Ding Ho was, and it's where I kind of really got my start. And there was folks like Paula Poundstone was the door person when I got there. And then she went up on stage, which I thought was funny. And then Stephen Wright, Dennis Leary, Kevin Meaney, a whole bunch of us came out of that scene. And then Barry ran other clubs after that one where folks like Mark Maron and David Cross got their start. So Barry was instrumental in the comedy scene.
Was he a comedy mentor for you?
Yeah, definitely. Not even a mentor as much as I would say his mentor, but sometimes I would just be scared, you know, because he had no, he made no bones about what you were going to do on stage. You know, it had to be original and it had to be your own thing, you know, and if it was derivative, he would let you know, you know, and then, so, or if he didn't like it, too, you know? So
he did not seem to be the kind of guy who would take it easy on you either way.
Yeah, no, if he didn't like it, he would let you know. So he was the kind of the gatekeeper, the standard bearer of the comedy scene there.
Yeah.
And so I made the documentary on him. It's not just about Boston and Barry, but for the listeners, most folks aren't familiar with Barry. They will be soon. Louis C.K. just directed a special of Barry's that'll come out.
Oh, good.
He's
still working. I'm glad you
did. Yeah, I pulled him out of retirement, basically. It's a horrible thing to do to a guy, you know? He had a nice life in central New York in the woods, and then I made this doc on him, and now he's...
When I reviewed your documentary, Call Me Lucky, about Barry, people thought I was kidding that this is a story about a guy who was very successful in the world of comedy and also very successful in going after the Catholic Church.
Yeah, and the government of the United States.
Because he was a survivor.
AOL. Yeah, he's a survivor.
Of priest abuse.
Yes, and then as an adult, you know, Barry was always this curmudgeon with a lot of anger, and then he... what's not 100% clear, what happened was Barry's sister, who's in the movie... She told him about what happened, and Barry had always had these memories, but to have someone else tell you this story, it was put into the forefront of his brain, and Barry disclosed on stage one night about the events that happened to him, and it set him on this path of trying to find other survivors. And when he found that the AOL was allowing child pornography to be exchanged, he tried to get that
Let me just stop
off.
You right now, yeah. Because this was the part of the movie where I said, oh my goodness, this guy's a hero.
Yeah.
Because not only was he a crusader against the Catholic Church to uncover these pedophile priests,
yeah.
but also America Online yeah. had these chat rooms where pedophiles and people who were into child pornography, they were sharing content yeah. with each other. This yeah. is back in the 90s.
Yeah, early 90s, mid-90s. Yeah, he called it a pedophile superstore. And AOL, when he complained to him, turned a deaf ear because this is back when you would pay money to upload. And it would take hours for these guys, so they were making
your dial-up modem.
Yeah, yeah, and they were making a lot of money off of everybody who was uploading stuff. But AOL didn't do anything. The police, and I'll have to say this about the police: they actually, because the police that are in the movie explained to me that we didn't have computers when this was going on. I mean, think about that. That's how crazy. And he went to the feds and AOL. No one did anything. So he's the first person that I'm aware of that actually posed as kids. These guys gave him their information. They gave him evidence, crime evidence, child pornography. He handed over the feds. What's not in the movie is there was about 110 arrests made. And the reason that's not in the movie was that the feds weren't really keen to go on camera and say, oh, yeah, this radical lefty lunatic comedian kind of did our job for us.
Yeah.
So Barry, but he went up to the floor of the Senate and took on AOL. And I'm telling everyone this story because it sounds dark and stuff. And but it is, I guess. It's it's a subject that it's heavy. But I will say this about the movie, and I don't usually talk about my own movies this way. I do think at the end of the day, it still actually is entertaining and funny.
Oh yeah,
and it's very hopeful
because Barry's a funny guy.
He's a funny guy, and it would be doing a disservice if I. It would be really funny, too, because if you see the movie, it's so heavy, and Barry's heavy, and there's all this stuff in it. But sometimes it'd be like, Barry, we got to talk about the church. You know, stop doing your Bluto voice. You know what I mean? Because he is a comedian.
Yes,
so,
he is.
So
I wonder if, in light of the movie Spotlight doing so well and winning the Academy Award,
yeah.
did you get any shared glory from the fact that people were seeing a movie about pedophile priests?
Not much. And it's funny because some of those, Barry was around there, during all that, too.
Because that took place in Boston.
Yeah. And we got a tiny bit of cross-pollination where people would say, well, if you like that movie, you should check that out.
Mm-hmm.
But I always wanted to do Call Me Lucky as a narrative movie, as a film with someone play Barry, because I didn't want Barry to relive this stuff. And, Robin Williams was my best pal. And he knew about this project, and he said to me, why don't you... He goes, you should do it as a documentary at this point, because I've been trying to make it for about 10, 15 years. And so I go, I don't have any money. So Robin gave me the money to start Call Me Lucky.
Wow.
And so it wouldn't have been made if it wasn't for Robin contributing and supporting and encouraging me to make the movie.
Is it streaming now?
Yeah, it's on Netflix and stuff.
It's called Call Me Lucky. It's a really, really terrific movie about
Thanks.
A guy who really is a hero. And you did a wonderful job mixing
Thanks.
Those two worlds.
Thanks. And now I am going to do a narrative version of it.
Okay.
I'm currently starting the process. I'm writing the screenplay with Judd Apatow, and he's going to produce, and I'm going to direct. So.
Well, that's a nice comedy pedigree to have working
with you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's funny you say comic relief, because I think that's where I met Judd. He was like an intern, and I was like, boy, I'm really glad I was nice to that kid.
Get away from the shower!
Yeah.
I hate you!
Yeah. Hey, dum-dum. I need some coffee. So that's where I'm at with the Call Me Lucky. And I'm working on a whole bunch of stuff. I've never been busier. I'm doing my own television series that I'm writing and directing for True TV. And that'll come out next spring. And then I'm shooting a pilot that I'm writing and directing at HBO with Michael Patrick King for Bridget Everett.
Wow, good. That's all great stuff.
So you're saying, why are you playing a funny bone?
No, I know why you're playing funny bone.
No, that's
because
even...
the check will clear.
No,
and you need the money now.
Yeah, I do need the cash. But I honestly, there's like two more cities that are on this tour, and I do love doing stand-up, but I will say they're a little bit of my contractual obligation tour.
Oh, really?
Well, okay. And I'm not saying, oh, I'm so fancy, but I was just like, I go, you know what? Don't be a jerk. Go do those shows. You said you're going to be there.
But you're not so jaded about it that tonight you'll show up for the first of the two shows and just sit in the stool and go, anybody have any questions?
Hello, anyone have a question for the auteur?
Yeah.
You know, when I'm not...
I got a question. How come you're not doing the voice anymore?
Yeah. Talk to the voice.
Boo.
So here's...
I'm not contractually obligated to it. That's why.
I'm surprised I haven't ran into that, you know, yet, where someone says, you know, that's not in a contract at a club. I mentioned Robin, and yesterday was the anniversary of his death. So
yeah, it's been 2 years.
So, but he is just a great guy, and he was doing a Snickers commercial, and then he said, well... Okay, I'll do the Snickers commercial. And by the way, I could use the bread at this time. He goes, but you need to put my friend Bobcat Goldthwait in it.
Oh, wow.
And they're going, okay, that guy's alive? No, so they were like, so Robin calls me and he goes, so I got you're going to be on a Snickers commercial with me, but they're going to call and tell him no. And they'll give you more money. I go, okay. So I said, no, I'm an artist. So then he calls me back and goes, okay, here's the deal, though. You have to do the voice. Are you okay with that? And I go, for the amount of money Snickers is paying, I will have sex with a Snickers bar on camera. I cleaned it up. By the way, I'd like to say it's a great candy bar for anyone from the Mars Corporation's listening.
Yeah. Still getting residuals, are you? Is
that the... No, but I had this thing that said I couldn't say anything negative about it in the contract. Do you know that in those kind of commercials, they write out specifically like how you're going to eat the product?
Really?
Yeah, you're going to take, I can't remember, it's like X amount of bites, and you're going to, you know, it's all in there. It's just like, did you know, like that's in a contract when there's nudity or a sex scene, like they'll be very specific about what you're going to show and what you're not going to show.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it doesn't go over any lines, I guess, on the day. I haven't yet crossed those lines.
I was going to ask, has that been a problem for you?
No. I mean, I did a romantic comedy with a tiny bit of bestiality, but all that was off camera and tastefully done.
It was suggested.
It was implied.
Yeah, it was implied bestiality.
But the SBCA almost shut me down because someone got a hold of the script and called, and they go, what's going on in this scene? I go, oh, in this scene, the Humane Society, not SBCA, he's so up. I go, they're leaving and they don't bring the dog in there. That's not what I heard.
Did the commercial have a little thing at the end? No Snickers bars were harmed.
No Snickers bars were harmed in the eating of it, which is in the making of, which is kind of funny because, I think I probably would eat Snickers now and then. I don't know.
Is it true that you and Robin once appeared on stage as Jack Cheese and Marty Fromage?
Well, no. You know, what it was it was back in the day when I had a lot of heat, and he and I just booked ourselves into a club, and I would use Jack Cheese. There's a couple movies that I show up in as Jack Cheese. So he said, that he'd be Marty Fromage. So on this marquee at a comedy club for a whole week, it was just a Jack Cheese and Marty Fromage. It was he and I, and we were getting ready to, I think we're getting ready to do a comic relief. So we'd go there every night. And I would go on after him because just because I knew he wanted to go home and stuff. But I would go on often after him. Like people go, oh, that's. But, you know, because his comedy was always, you know, life reaffirming and, you know, everything's wonderful, you know. And then I would come out and just be really negative.
Didn't want you to bring the room down, but he could certainly bring it back up.
No, I just honestly, I just, I, I, I just liked my friend, and I knew that he always had a close, and I just said, I don't care, I'll go on after you. So, yeah, we did a bunch of dates together like that.
Did people know ahead of time that it was a
two-year? Yeah, it got out through the club, so because of him, you know, not because of me, the tickets sold out, and, yeah, it was crazy, and it was fun. And there was, like, scalper situations by the end of the week where people were trying to get in, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it was, Robin and I always was kind of closed-lipped about our friendship, but, you know, I was his best man, different, you know, I didn't have anyone that I spoke with more than him in my life the past 10 years easily, you know.
Wow. So, would the two of you talk about things that you were going to do either on stage or on screen or elsewhere?
All the time.
And give each other advice, don't do that, or maybe you could try this?
Well, no, we've talked about that kind of stuff all the time, but it wasn't ever don't do it, you know. It was more, this is not that scathingly personal, but I don't think people would think of Robin in these terms, and so I hate to, I'm going to tell the story anyways. But we would sit around on this isn't juicy, but we would sit with a legal pad and write bits, you know, and we'd have a stack, you know, and say, yeah, that, but like sometimes when they would veer a little too morbid or whatever, he's like, oh, that's for your pile, you know. It'd be like that's for you, you know. It's a little too dark, you know.
So there was a division of Bobcat material and Robin material.
Yeah, kind of.
That's fascinating. I also want to mention another movie you made, which I really, really enjoyed, called God Bless America.
Yeah, well, thanks.
And here's
it's
the point.
It's a very violent movie about kindness, is what I like to say.
It's a movie starring Joel Murray.
Yeah.
Of the Bill Murray family.
Yeah, and Joel was on Mad Men. He was Freddie Rumsen.
Yeah.
And you would recognize Joel. Joel's definitely that guy.
Right, yeah. And he plays a guy who, if I recall correctly, is terminally ill.
Yeah, he's diagnosed with a brain tumor, and he is about to commit suicide, and then he starts watching that show, My Super Sweet 16, on MTV, and he decides he's going to take the girl out before he kills himself. And then he does, and her classmate's like, did you kill Chloe? And he doesn't say anything, and she goes, awesome. So Joel's whole thing, and his character Frank in that movie, is just, he just has had it, and he's just killing people who aren't kind anymore.
It's not just that they're not kind. In many cases, they are idiots or antisocial jerks or the kind of people who, if anybody else had the opportunity, you'd go, you know what? Our society would be better off without you.
Right, but that sounds a little bit like the Final Solution. So I get nervous when you say
good
that.
Good point.
But good point. I want to know something. When we were making the movie, because there's so much violence in it, sometimes people would worry. They go, are you worried about copycats? And kind of glibly, I would say, no, because by the time this movie comes out, things are going to be way more violent, and I can't believe how much they escalated. I mean, now that movie looks tame, and it was only a few years ago compared to the kind of murder sprees we've had. So sadly, it ended up being not as violent as our culture turned out to be.
Yeah, why didn't anybody see that movie? Was it even released?
Well, my movies escape. They don't get released. catch and release program. My movies, the ones that I've made, they're always very small. When I first started making movies and they weren't going to get a theatrical run or a big theatrical run, my ego would be depressed. And now when I make a movie, I can't wait for it to get to the digital platform. You know, I can't wait for it to get to iTunes and Netflix. You know, that's where people watch the movies I make, which is cool. You know, I usually make a movie about every year, year and a half, but I've actually been kind of on the busier side of things. So this new series hopefully will help me in that, because they're all similar stories to the kind of movies I make.
Mm-hmm.
But they're just half an hour. So I get to make 8 now. excuse me, instead of waiting a year and a half in between.
Has it been a struggle financially to get the money to make these movies? Because you're not putting your own bucks into them.
But you know what's funny? They always say you don't put your own money, and two of them I did. And those two were the ones that I made the most money off of.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because I owned it. So when they said, oh, we want to buy it, I could say no. And then, yeah, so the two that I put my own money in were the ones where the money came back.
Which were those?
I did a scary Bigfoot movie called Willow Creek.
Yep.
And then that the rom-com bestiality film, Sleeping Dogs Lie. Those were the two that were, because I put money into it, I actually saw money. And I also always give my actors points, which means absolutely nothing. Like I would get a point in a Police Academy movie, and according to Warner Brothers, Police Academies have not made money yet.
Oh, Hollywood accounting guys.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I mean, they haven't made money
And
yet.
By the way, people are going to think you're joking around.
Oh, no, not, yeah, yeah.
Gone with the Wind is still not profitable.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, even with Bill Clinton giving a plug at the DNC, Police Academy still is not. But my movies are so tiny that when I give an actor a point or a couple points, you know, they actually see money and they're always shocked and happy, so that's cool. I'm doing this new series right now. I don't know if it'll stay this. It's just called Bobcat Goldthwait's Messed Up Stories.
Is it an anthology? Each week will be a different show?
Yeah, so kind of like Black Mirror or Twilight Zone, but, you know, they're comedic and they're a bit on the fable side. They're like parables and they're all... I'm very happy at how well this series is going. I think the network is actually a fan, which is cool.
But which network will it be on?
It's on True, which has started to rebrand themselves doing a lot of comedy.
Okay.
And I work on one of the shows on there now that's called Those Who Can't, which is a really funny show about horrible, horrible teachers. Like the first episode of that show, they hate one of the students, so they buy heroin and put it in his locker. So it's
okay. The teachers do that?
Yeah, the teachers did it. Yeah. And I love that that's the pilot. Like, well, are you in or are you out? You know, so
now I'm curious, when you're doing your own TV series,
yeah,
all the other stuff we've been talking about here came from your brain. The movies you wrote and directed.
Right.
The stand-up stuff you've always written and done your own stuff, although Robin gave you some ideas. But
But
when you're doing a TV series, do you hire writers? Do you have people coming to you and saying, here, what? I got something for you. How does that work?
Well, the anthology series is I'm not hiring writers because they are stories that I've had in my head for years and stories I want to tell. But the show that I'm doing over at HBO, if that gets greenlit, that'll be a traditional writer's room. Because it came, the germ of it all came from Michael Patrick King, who's he did Sex and the City and Two Broke Girls, and he does and the Comeback. So, you know, he and I and Bridget Everett, who stars in it, wrote the pilot, and then there'll be a regular writer's room for that if it gets a green
light. Are you directing too, or just?
Yeah, I'm directing and producing that one also. So I'm doing all these things. I don't know what the hell's going on. The only thing I can figure is, and I don't believe in karma or anything, but I had a year where I got a divorce. My best friend kills himself. I was with a woman who we broke up decorating the Christmas tree. And then I would spend 8 to 12 hours a day editing a child abuse movie. Yeah. So
wow.
Yeah, it was a lot of laughs. That
would
year.
Be the dark year.
Yeah, so all of a sudden this year everything's like all these things, and I was like, I don't know if there's karma, but I don't know what happened, but this is the most exciting period I've ever had in my whole career of 30-some years.
That's great. Congratulations.
Yeah, it's really nuts.
I mentioned at the beginning that you directed a whole bunch of other stuff, including Chappelle and Marc Maron.
Yeah.
And you did Jimmy Kimmel Live for several years, which I want to come back to in a second. But what's it like for a comedian to direct another comedian?
I think it's I've never, and I've done a lot of stand specials, I never give anyone notes on the performance of how they're delivering their material for you know, that wouldn't be right. But I think my job when I'm directing a comedian is making them feel safe, that they're being heard, and that and I act as a buffer between them and the people in charge. Like when I did Chappelle, the Comedy Central executives, I'm trying to clean this up for radio, but the white Comedy Central executives would come in.
That's
there.
How you know it's a good story, when you have to clean it up for radio.
Well, and they would go, Bobcat, could you ask Dave not to say the N-word so much? but they didn't use that term.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Dave, the white Comedy Central executives would prefer if you didn't say the N-word. And he goes, Bobcat, pshaw, what did you say? So they were just embarrassed and left the set. So, you know, people act like Dave's crazy, but he's not. He's a really sharp guy. And I was there at the beginning of that show, and I saw those people run him out of there. You know, I know he quit and he had a chance to make a lot of money, but they were micromanaging him, you know. So that's the last thing you can do to Dave, you know.
Yeah, which is probably one of the reasons you do solo projects, so that you're in charge of what goes in and what comes out.
Yeah, but, you know, I've done that for years, and now I put my toe in, and I've started to find environments and places that are encouraging me to be as weird as I am, so it's nice.
Back to Jimmy Kimmel. You did that show for several years. How hard is it to direct a talk show?
It's like...
scale of 10.
I would say, as far as directing goes, it's the hardest job I've had.
Really?
Sure, because it's not directing performances and cutting a thing later on. Because when I first started doing the show, it was still live.
Yeah.
So a live television show there's like a 7-second delay, and it's going, it's like landing a plane in Chinese, you know.
Wow.
And it took me a little while to learn what are priorities, what are you listening to, what are you not listening to. You know, the thing about the show that I thought I would add to it was a lot of people are so worried about everything else but the show. I would try my hardest to listen to what's going on so I could cut to and reflect to it live on the air.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my style was a little bit like... like a hip hop artist would come out and he'd say, well, you know, it's all about the peeps and my fans. And then I would cut to this awkward white couple from from Oklahoma that were visiting the show, you know.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of keeping your eye on the ball. But, you know, Jimmy and I are still pals. And I didn't leave that show. It was one of my favorite jobs. But I just started having success making my own movies. So I left after I did 300 some episodes. It's a lot.
Would you tell the nose story?
Oh, sure. When Nickelback was on.
Again, like what he said before about I had to clean it up for the radio. Any story that starts with when Nickelback was on, it's going to be a good story.
I think that they might be nice guys, but their manager was a jerk. And he came into the booth, which was weird. And he said, who's the director? And I go, I am. And he's like, well, really? You know, no, he didn't recognize me. That happened when the Motley Crue's director came in the booth. There we go. That was really funny. They put me on the phone with Nikki Sixx. They go, I'm going to put, hey, Nikki, this is a, put you on the phone with Bobcat Goldthwait. He's the director. No, I'm serious. No, same guy. So the manager of Nickelback goes, don't shoot Chad profile, only shoot him straight on. And I'm like, who's Chad? And he's like, our lead singer. I go, oh, okay. So now,
wait, can I just interrupt you for just a second? This is so typical of what can happen so many times, because you have 1,000 things you're thinking about and you're doing 4 or 5 shows a week.
Yeah,
you got all these different people coming through.
And he doesn't want me to shoot this guy's profile.
But all he cares about is his band, and so he's shocked that you don't know the name of the lead singer of Nickelback.
Chad.
So he says, now, I go, why not? He goes, because he has a large nose. So I go, so just shoot him on the side. I go, okay, I won't shoot him. So just shoot him profile. I go, okay, so I won't shoot him from the side. And the crew, I'll clean this up. They're like, they called me a derogatory term.
Because you gave in.
Yeah, that was cat related. And
yes, we got it.
And so, if you've seen the show, they do 2 songs and then the show goes off the air during the second song when a band's a guest. So during the second song, I said to my assistant director, I go, Kathy, tell me when I have 10 seconds left. And she goes, okay. And I'm like, camera 6, camera 3. Camera 4, and then she goes, 10 seconds. And I go, shoot the nose. And 7 cameras zoomed in on this guy's nose. And I made a nose montage. And then we were off the air. And it got really quiet. And the crew goes, hey, man, what are we going to do now? I go, I'm getting in my car. So I actually just split. It went out to the East Coast. It did not make it the rest of the country. They actually just, the one camera that couldn't zoom in was the big wide. So all of a sudden, it's just this big wide shot.
Wait a second. Who made that decision?
Oh, after I left, it went live to the East Coast. But then after I left, clearly the manager went in there and freaked out. So they re-edited it and scrambled.
So the
montage, because I clearly have tried to look it up. It does not exist.
It's not on YouTube?
No, I think if I called, I could actually call the post supervisor and he could probably dig it up for me. But then he'd probably get in trouble. I actually, when I was promoting Call Me Lucky, told Jimmy that story on the air.
Yeah?
Which,
he didn't know?
No, there's a lot of stories that I think now I have a good thing, a nice running, like, because there's other stories that are gonna probably flip them out that I want to tell on the air someday and surprise them.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
So when the new series is ready, you can go back on there and share some of that with them.
Yeah, hopefully. You know, So I'm excited about the new series. And
can I just add this on the end of the nose story? I would have assumed that Jimmy Kimmel would have been in on that decision to not have it on the West Coast. But you're telling me a couple of years went by and you had to go back on the show and he still had not been told?
Oh, no, because you know, Jimmy, when he's doing that show, it's just this machine. And so no one went to Jimmy and said, hey, Nickelback's manager is mad about the nose.
We have to cut out the Chad nose thing.
Yeah, because often, too, you know, Jimmy's working and then the bands come on, and sometimes he's not sitting. He's gone.
All right, let's get the plugs in, and then I'm going to let you go.
So
you can have a nap before you have to work tonight.
Yeah, I got to do two shows tonight and two shows tomorrow at the
Funny Bone, right here at Westport, here in St. Louis. And then
314-469-6692.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And funnybonestl.com.
Yeah, and folks can check out the movies. That's a good plug. If you want to check out Call Me Lucky, that's on Netflix. And
what about God Bless America?
God Bless America, I think so, too. If they're not on Netflix, they're usually available on iTunes.
Or if they're not streaming, they're still available on DVD.
Yeah, and you can catch some of my movies. I know someone illegally put Windy City Heat on YouTube, which all of us involved don't care. So go ahead and watch it.
Here's the headline from today's show. Bobcat Goldthwait, pro-pirating.
Well, you can't, you know, what are you going to do? I was walking down a plane, and this kid was watching God Bless America, and I was like, I'm going to blow his mind. I go, hi, I'm Bobcat Goldthwait. I directed and wrote that movie. I paid for it. That's what he said. That's a true story. It really happened. And what I think is really funny is he didn't pay for it because it wasn't available yet. So but I love this idea that he was so...
But he rationalized that if he had laid out 20 bucks for it, he could do whatever he wants.
Yeah, but I also was like, dude, I don't care. You know, I'm glad you're just watching him.
That's funny. Well, it's really a pleasure to sit down and talk
to you. Thank you. Thanks a lot. I
appreciate you coming in here. Is this the first interview you've done in a while that didn't mention the series?
Police Academy?
I wasn't even going to say the words.
Probably, you know, it's the local news, which is the hard one, because they scramble to find images of you. So you know, often, although this morning wasn't like that, but 99% of the time.
That's the picture.
They play a clip. Da, 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 da. And I get it. You know, they're like, and then they go, we're talking to Bobcat Goldthwait. You made a documentary about child abuse. You know? And it's like, seriously, guys, that's the best you can. Yeah.
Well, I loved a lot of the work you've done.
And well, thank you.
Having almost seen you nude 30 years ago, it's a pleasure to see you fully dressed in our studio here today.
Thank you so much.
Bobcat Goldthwait here on the Big 550 KTRS.